Blog Talk Radio.
Oh,
there it is. Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss every day. And we're going to have a really exciting show. Someone killed Charlie Lowe. Blackmail, blacklisted, fear, hate, prejudice, greed, and two people targeted for sexual purposes as voices are heard, jinx support, and the end result will shock readers as the final names and finalists and someone was cleared on the HUAC list and final words in the script will be written and seal the fate of so many. When Hoover meets Marshall and we learn the truth behind the murders, what was in the ledgers, what was stolen from Ernest's office, what will be the final outcome of those centered lives on profiting from being part of the naming game. And this book takes place in the McCarthy era, and this is fantastic. And I would like to welcome the author of The Naming Game, Gabriel Vajon. Good morning, and I'm glad you're here.
Good morning. Good morning, friend. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so this is the second book in the series, right?
And that's correct. The first one was called The Good Man, and this one is The Naming Game. So it's a continuation of some of the characters you met in the first book, but this time they're in Los Angeles, and it's 1951.
And this is really interesting. So tell us about Marshall and the company, and what is his relationship with Walker? And Walker seemed to be having fun in his new job, too, for some reason.
Sure. So as I said, this is the second book in the series. Jack Marshall and Walker are two men who served in the U.S. Army together. In the first book, we learn that Jack has been tasked to do foreign intelligence, which is the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA. With the war over and that assignment over, he comes back to the United States. Jack is living in D.C. His friend Walker, who works with him, is out in L.A. He, you know, has a home in what is Malibu. So Jack gets a call one day and basically is informed that he should look into a murder that's in Los Angeles. And Jack at that time is on vacation house sitting. So he goes down and looks at the murder scene, and he discovers that it's a screenwriter that was murdered. And he was basically tipped off that he should look into this. This wasn't just any ordinary murder. And what ends up happening is he has Walker go undercover in one of the Hollywood studios where this murdered screenwriter had worked and try to figure out what had happened to this guy and why he was murdered.
Wouldn't everybody like to know? So explain why Betty, John's wife, has a problem with his job and his long hours. What makes her think that he's not doing the right thing? And how does it put a strain on a family and a marriage? That was really tough.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to do in this particular outing was to introduce readers to, I don't want to use the word collateral damage, but I wanted to show people the effect of doing this kind of work has on family. And Jack, as I said, you know, was house sitting. He's on vacation with his wife. He has two children. And now he gets this assignment dropped in his lap. And, you know, his wife, again, this is 1950, you know, marriages were different. Wives were very accommodating and yielding, often to their own detriment. But Jack is married to a woman, Betty, who is very candid, and she knows what he does, even though she doesn't ask for details. But she's now realizing that he's an absent father and an absent husband. And she takes him to task at times about being absent for the children. And that's a story arc that I hope to develop, you know, as the series goes on. But Jack is the only one that really has a solid relationship. Walker is a single man. Another character you meet in the story, Leslie, who you met in the book one, is also a single woman by choice. You know, she had enjoyed a sense of independence in the, you know, during the war and is not ready to give that up.
I don't blame her. But she's an interesting character, and she and Walker sort of mesh together, which makes it really interesting. So, and in this novel, for those people that don't know McCarthy era, people were blacklisted, movie stars, merchants, everybody, God. So within this novel, there are many actors, and we learn that the blacklist created by McCarthy and the death of Charlie Lowe. How does his death become an integral part of the plot, and why did you choose this time period? Because it's very interesting.
Well,
seriously.
Well, the reason I chose it, I mean, I think it's something, it's an era or a time period that people know of, maybe distantly, but I don't think they really understood the details. So
yeah.
McCarthy came out and literally waved a paper and said, I have the names of 200, you know, communist spies in the U.S. government and in the army. He never produced names. He just, you know, waved a piece of paper around and generated this frenzy. Contrary to what people might think, McCarthy actually did not sit on the McCarthy Committee. He appointed or had appointed people, you know, some were senators. Young Robert Kennedy was originally on the committee. Roy Cohn, who stayed on the committee, and that's part of the reason why Robert Kennedy left. These people interrogated known or supposed communists, and they threatened them. They wanted to have them name people. And they focused on Hollywood because this is where supposedly liberal and very avant-garde radical thinking was occurring. And they called up actors, directors, writers, and they, you know, said, you know, we're hearing that you're a communist, or do you know communists?
Mm-hmm.
Some people named names. The thing that I think people lose track of was that when we use the word blacklisted, they were not blacklisted in the sense that, you know, they were legally punished, although Dashiell Hammett was. They basically, the Hollywood studios blacklisted the writers and said, okay, we have a perception problem here. So what they did, and I tried to bring this out in the book, was that they had very talented writers, but they couldn't put it on the screen that this film was written by so-and-so because that person basically had a black eye in the public newspapers because of being called up to the McCarthy era. So what they did was they put these writers in the back of the room and they basically had them use pseudonyms and they paid them more or less under the table, or as in the case of my murdered screenwriter, he was the go-between, the studio and the people that needed the money and wanted to continue their livelihood as writers. So what I thought was interesting in this book was that Hollywood studios were saying that they were very anti-communist, but in reality, they never really got rid of the writers. I mean, they just kind of put them in the back of the room and had them continue their jobs because they wanted to continue having films out and continue, you know, producing films and having people go to the movie theaters.
That's interesting. I don't think people really know that. I think they were under the impression that these people couldn't write and do movies anymore. So,
well, a lot of them couldn't use their names.
Yeah, I know.
You know, what, Dalton Trumbo was a perfect example. You know, for many, many years, he could not use his name, but he actually wrote, you know, 20, 30 films while he was blacklisted. It was only until I want to say the 60s when Stanley Kubrick did Spartacus. Stanley Kubrick essentially said, no, this is wrong. And he put Dalton's name back on the screen. And then because the film did well and Kirk Douglas was behind it, I think he got nominated for an Oscar. But the point was, Dalton Trumbo had to basically hide in his house and write. And at times he went down to Mexico. The movie with Bryan Cranston really covers this really well, you know, what he had to do to make a buck. Like I said, the only person that I know that really suffered was Dashiell Hammett, because he was held in contempt of court and he actually was thrown in prison.
That is sad. So he was sent Walker to work in Warner Brothers Studios as a writer. Now, he went to whatever, but actually he seemed to be enjoying himself. How come? I mean, I don't think he wanted to leave. He was learning a lot.
Well,
and I thought it was interesting because I learned a lot.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to develop in his character. You know, in The Good Man, in the first installment, he just kind of joined Jack because Jack called him up and said, you know, I need you, come with me. And, you know, Walker at that point is a young man. He doesn't really know what to do with himself after the war. He's still processing everything that he went through. In the second book, in The Naming Game, I briefly allude to the fact that he took some writing classes, you know, under the GI Bill, and he enjoyed it, but he's not a confident guy. But when he goes into the Warner Brothers, which was in Burbank, he starts having fun. He's learning things about writing, and he's enjoying it. And he's enjoying the people he's meeting. And I also think it heightens his sense of observation. But I think, you know, one of the things I'm going to be developing is him developing his own confidence as a storyteller, as a writer. Now, whether or not that conflicts with what Jack wants or with his work with the company remains to be seen.
That's interesting. I was hoping you would do something like that because I like Walker. So he meets Warner, and
yes.
Warner gives him the names in order to, you know, and did Warner really give up names in order to benefit himself? I mean, that was interesting, too. I go, like, of all the things of Warner Brothers, and he gave up names also? Did he really do that?
Right. He did do that. He did it out of spite because...
Yeah.
What had happened with Jack Warner was, and this was not uncommon, when FDR was president during World War II, he had asked a lot of Hollywood to help promote the war effort. So you had people like Carol Lombard doing war bonds. She unfortunately died in a tragic plane accident. You had five directors. You had John Ford, Capra, William Wyler. These were all directors that the government hired, and some of them actually received a commission as an officer in, you know, the various military branches, and they went and filmed, you know, to document the war, one, to kind of promote morale. And what had happened with Jack Warner was he was a staunch Republican all his life. FDR, as you know, was a Democrat, and FDR had asked him to do a film, and a lot of his Republican buddies turned on him. And then he lost money doing films, and he got a lot of flack for being associated with liberal writers and with the Democrats. So when he got called up for a status report of communists at Warner Brothers, he named, I think, like 10 or 12 names just to be spiteful, to get back at people.
Oh, God. Reminds me of today.
Yes.
And you listen to the news, yeah.
Yes.
Just to be spiteful. There are some people running the government that just love to do that, especially their little tweets.
Right. And yeah. I tried in The Naming Game to show aspects of Hollywood history that people might not know.
Yeah.
So, for example, Ronald Reagan, who is, as we know, was an actor before he became a politician, first as a governor and then later as president. He was, again, like a lot of people in his era, staunchly anti-communist. However, Reagan was also very anti-labor. So he essentially busted up attempts at unionization in the Hollywood studio system. So he makes a cameo in the book, I mean, briefly. But, you know, I try to illustrate things that people might not see, but were very indicative of the era. Sometimes things were done with the best of intention, but ended up having horrible results.
I know what you're saying. So what happens when he decides to take, he becomes a writer, first an editor, then a script writer, and he loves what he's doing. So who is Terrence Doyle and Joe Teague, and what roles do they play? Because I'm sitting there saying, this is so interesting to learn the difference between an editor and a script writer. And, of course, on the 17th, I'm doing a show with Lee Goldberg, Alan Jacobson, Stephen J. Schwartz, Tess Gerrington, and Lawrence Block, and it's about getting your script into Hollywood and what happens when things don't exactly go the way you want.
That sounds really exciting.
I was asked to do it out of nowhere. Yeah.
Well, I had a lot of fun doing this because it, you know, I, without getting into the nerd talk or, you know, getting, you know, really nerdy about writing, I had Walker basically, you know, he essentially gets hired as a temp and he has to prove himself before he becomes hired permanent. So he is assigned to the writer's room, which was an actual room at Warner Brothers, and he was given a mentor. His mentor is Terry Doyle, who tries to guide Walker into storytelling and narrative, but makes it very clear that what you read for literature, you know, in magazines and books, is very different from what you do as a screenwriter. And, you know, I was getting into how films were done at the time. So, you know, Terry basically tells him, you know, no, we're not going to do voiceovers. That's a thing of the past. The camera can give you the mood and the texture and the, you know, the psychology of where we're going. Now we got to deal with dialogue. So he talks to Terry, follows Terry's advice, forms his own style. Terry takes him around Burbank in L.A. and introduces him to other writers, takes him to parties. This is where he meets Joe Teague. We find out that Joe Teague himself was a writer, but now he's kind of like the murdered script writer. He's a free agent, but we really don't know what he's doing. But we do know that Joe likes to hang out at nightclubs, and this is where you meet a lot of gangsters. You meet a lot of other writers, and everybody's got their own agenda. So Walker is trying to figure out Terry's angle. He's trying to figure out Joe's angle. And, of course, you know, fulfill the assignment of, well, who killed this guy and why?
It's sort of like it goes into who killed him and why, but they want to know a whole lot more about everything else. Now, this character I found extremely interesting. And what you did with her, Leslie, was extremely even more interesting. So who is Vera Williams and what brought her into the fold? And then we have John Hamilton and Dr. Ernest, and they both see him. How come?
Okay, so when I was doing some research on this era, one of the things I had learned was that the studio system and J. Edgar Hoover were kind of at odds with each other because J. Edgar Hoover was extremely conservative and extremely authoritarian. A lot of the names that came up in the McCarthy era often came up from moles that FBI had planted in the Hollywood system. So some of it was not new information. Hoover had planted a psychiatrist in L.A. who essentially was collecting data on Hollywood stars. He was, you know, recording and taking notes on their sessions and trying to get information as to their political affiliations. Now, bear in mind, you know, when we think of that today, we think of that as a violation of medical ethics or professional ethics. Psychiatry in the 50s was actually very new. You didn't need a license. You basically can get accredited in a short-term correspondence course, and just call yourself a psychoanalyst. Jack has Leslie go in as Dr. Ernest's secretary, and the reason he gets that lead was through John Hamilton, who is actually based on the actor Sterling Hayden. John Hamilton was his actual alias. Maybe this is something that people don't know, but Sterling Hayton originally started out as a poster boy and a up-and-coming actor. He was called the Viking God because he was blonde, tall, and good-looking. And then World War II broke out, and he used an alias to enlist, and nobody knew it. He did commando training in the UK, then went into the Marines, was highly decorated combat veteran, never talked about it. He actually worked for the OSS. His operations with the CIA were declassified, I think, around 2008, 2006. So one of the major problems that Sterling Hayton had in his life was he found acting to be kind of a con job, and he didn't really think it was real work, so he felt guilty about that. He felt guilty about kind of giving names to the McCarthy Committee, and he tells Jack that he was talking to a shrink about this. So Leslie goes in to see what she can ferret out of this guy, and she ends up meeting a older actress, Vera, and, you know, we get to see what Hollywood does to older women.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a friendship or a relationship that I thought would be a lot of fun for readers.
Be unique for readers, too. I was like, oh, my God, I saw that coming, but not really. And I go like, whoa,
yeah.
It was interesting, really interesting, especially knowing Leslie. So Vera seems vulnerable, and she wants to be recognized because she gives these cool parties that are really great and heads of studios.
Yes.
So what does this do for her and them? Because she seems to, you know, thrive on this, and that seems to get her into places that most people wouldn't get into.
Well, Vera is an older actress, and like I said, she's a client of Dr. Ernest. Leslie, as we know from book one, was actually a spy, worked for the British, and then, you know, came over to the American side. And as I said earlier, she didn't want to give up her independence. You know, women in that era basically were told, you know, come home, you know, you don't have to work in the factory anymore, get married, have children, keep a house. She's not into that. And I think she liked Vera because Vera was this person who was independent. She was divorced. She did her own thing. She threw these parties. At these parties, you see people that are script writers. You see people that are actors. You see people that are gay. You see people that, you know, are from a different era in some ways because she's an earlier actor before 1950. But now she's considered too old. And I think her and Leslie have that common bond of feeling out of place and trying to find their way now and redefine themselves in a new era.
I could see that. So why does she see Dr. Ernest? And, of course, I couldn't put my finger on it at first, but I did finally put my finger on it and go, like, I don't like this guy at all. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the general premise that I have is, you know, here she is. She's a movie actress. She's not getting many roles. And this, you know, happens. And unfortunately, I think it still happens today that many actresses, once they reach past their quote unquote prime, they're now given roles of spinsters and, you know, the older married, unmarried, widowed, whatever, divorce. So she goes to Dr. Ernest because she needs somebody to talk to. She's depressed. She's financially okay, but she wants to work. And she's frustrated and depressed that she can't land roles.
That's sad. You know,
I don't want to give
I just
any more
wrote
than
this
that.
On my paper. No, I don't. I hate, you know, I'll call a doctor's office or I'll call a charge call, whatever. I'll walk into a store and they'll go, what's your date of birth? And I go, I don't know. I forgot. And I can't stand age discrimination. I hate that. And that's the first question they ask you is, what's your date of birth? I go, can I pick one? I can pick a month and a day, but I'm not going to pick the year. Make one up. And I get annoyed because the minute you tell them the truth is the minute they think, oh, my God, is she alive? Is she senile? Does she know anything? I go, no, of course not. After all, what can I say? So
well, there's that.
I hate that.
Yeah, that's overt. And there are subtle ways that I found that people try to figure out your age. Another subtle way is they ask you about your education. So they'll say, did you go to college? And then once you tell them, they're like, oh, you know, what year did you graduate? They start doing the backward math to figure out, you know, your age from that.
I never tell them. And if I tell them I have four masters and a PD, it gets them really nervous. And I go, yeah, I got them one right after the other. I don't tell them. No.
But, you know, with Vera, I think the roles are, you know, what she's experiencing, I think, still occurs today in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, you have great actresses. I mean, you saw it happen to Bette Davis. She had these great roles, and then all of a sudden she was made to be the spinster or the crazy aunt. And then, you know, you didn't have, with very few exceptions, you didn't have women writers. You know, obviously, the one example, the exception I can think of is Ida Lupino, who transitioned from acting to behind the camera. And then, you know, she was involved with writing also.
What was Charlie really doing? Because we have to just talk a little bit about him. What was he really doing? We're not going to ask too much about more about Harvey Hulu because we know what he was doing. But what about Charlie? What was he really there for?
So Charlie basically was a guy who was a screenwriter. He's extremely gifted. I actually call him a script doctor. And that was an actual term for somebody who was just more than a screenwriter. They can go get a script, you know, written by a writer, and they can fix it. They can fix what's wrong with it. So they were kind of an editor, but at the same time, most of the time, they didn't put their name behind it. So a good example of that was Irving Thalberg. He worked on a lot of scripts, but he never put his name on him. He got, you know, scripts that were troubled or something was wrong with it, and then he would fix it. Charlie's doing that kind of work. The difference, however, is because he's so wired into the community, and this is something that I think a lot of people lose sight of. Back in the golden age of Hollywood, a studio actually owned you. You couldn't, you know, it's not like today where like, oh, okay, I got a role and it's going to be with Paramount, and then, you know, I finish that project and I get a role and it's with Warner Bros. When back then you worked for that studio exclusively, so your loyalty was with that. And I think it was Barbara Stanwyck or Bette Davis. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure; I don't remember. But they broke their contract and they actually got blackballed. They couldn't get any work because they broke away from their home studio. Charlie is somebody who can work through the different studios because one of the things that the studios did back then was they allowed other studios to borrow talent. So in other words, they could borrow an actor. They can borrow a writer. So you were, I don't want to use the word slave, but you were property. You were considered to be paid well, and you did what you were told. If they gave you a script and you didn't like it, you had to be very, very careful about what you turned away. That's where the expression box office poison came. It, you know, the idea that you were poison, you know, because you were. I think the modern term today is difficult to work with. In other words, if you keep criticizing the script, or you keep, you know, asking for rewrites. I mean, they allowed you some latitude, but the point was that if they gave you a movie that was absolutely horrendous, and you couldn't say no. But
that's scary. So why would somebody do a job like that? Why would Charlie? Why would anybody want to do that? You sort of like have no choice, and you're sort of compromising what you might think is to write better. So why would somebody do that?
Well, I think, you know, maybe, you know, the thinking was a little bit different. I mean, you have to bear in mind that a lot of the folks that we think of the golden age Hollywood, you know, some of them worked up through the ranks. You know, John Wayne, for example, started out as a stunt coordinator, not a stunt coordinator, but a stuntman. He worked with Tom Mix on Westerns. They looked at it as a job. You were paid extremely well. We lose sight of dollar amounts of, cost of living was a lot different, but an actor or somebody involved in a studio, whether they were a carpenter or a stage person, whatever, they were paid well relative to other people in the country. So, and some of them obviously were scarred by the Depression. Some of them, looked at it as, I have a steady job. I'm making in 1 week what some people make in 6 months to a year. So I think they didn't question it. They just looked at it as, I have a job. It's stars started feeling like they had the leverage to ask for better roles.
Mm. So when the studio decides to investigate his murder, what leads Walker to realize that there's something not kosher?
I think it's safe to say that the studio was hoping to let Charlie's death go unnoticed. And Jack doesn't want to. And we realize there's other people at play here other than just the studio. I think the point was that Jack was notified at the beginning to look into this murder because it was to his interest. And I don't want to say more than that because there's more to the plot. The studio has basically just tried to, have life go on and just have the factory continue. And that's the point. Joe Teague is, there's always somebody there to replace you.
Well, tell us more about Moore. I don't like him either. And tell us about his encounters with Warner, and why he seemed to be looking over his shoulder all the time. Well, everybody seemed to be looking over their shoulder the whole time. You couldn't really trust anybody at all.
No, and that's one of the things I tried to convey in the story was how Hollywood studios were very much a factory. You did what you were told. You kept your head low because you could be here today, gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with studio executives or movie moguls. All the large heads of the studios really were like dictators. I mean, they had their own police force. They kept tabs on people, surveillance. They were tied in with the tabloids. They could promote or demote somebody's career. They had a lot of power. And Jack Warner, like most of the moguls, was very, very larger than life. He takes a liking to Walker. He asks Walker to work on a special project for him. And Walker sees that as a challenge for his reading abilities and also because that particular project draws from his personal experience as a veteran. Jack Warner, I'm not sure if a lot of people know this, was Canadian. He wasn't American. Mm. But like some of the moguls, he came from a German-Jewish background. So there was a, there was a sense of obligation or a sense of loyalty both to the country and also to recognizing or reconciling the past. Because of what they were starting to learn about the Holocaust. but, at this point in the 50s, a lot of things were changing in entertainment. We see Milton Berle coming up. We see variety shows. Jack Parr. Things were changing from vaudeville and other styles of entertainment. And Jack Warner actually was trying as a businessman to stay ahead of the curve, but also keep his sense of what he thought was entertainment. He had very, very set ideas of what entertainment were. He tried different things. He was looking at Technicolor. He was looking at three-dimensional cameras. At one point, we know now, but he was the one that really got involved with cartoons. And he didn't take them serious. And then he sold them and then regretted it.
that's just different. So why does Terry seem to be an ally to Walker? And what does he reveal to Marshall? Who's above Marshall? And why does Walker seem to be, he's having too much fun, seriously. I don't think he wants to quit.
Well, I think Terry and Walker develop a relationship, but as I said earlier, I think, you know, Walker sees Terry as somebody who has experience. He sees him as a mentor, and he learns a lot from him about writing. I think Terry is, I don't want to say in his own world, but I think he's his own man. He's trying to survive the system. You know, he's aware, he's acutely aware of Jack Warner's power. You know, Terry sort of has his own past in the system. You know, I try to introduce a little bit of comedy, not comedy, funny moments, but actually were based on history. You know, there's an incident in the book regarding Rin Tin Tin, the dog, and
I
Jack Warner.
Rin Tin Tin. My mother loved Rin Tin Tin.
Yes. Yes, and, you know, I have cameos with James Cagney. I have a brief one with Humphrey Bogart. Those were all actually drawn from history. Cagney was a fascinating character. But like I said, he just has a very, very small appearance in the book. But I think also, too, Walker's trying to figure out Terry's angle. You know, is Terry a suspect? You know, how deep is he involved in this? Is he is he profiting from this in some way, or is he just a guy that's just trying to survive and make a buck?
Well, before I forget, on Thursday, somebody we know and love, the caretaker's wife, Vincent Zandri. Oh yes, and then my panel show, Hollywood versus the Author, on Monday on the 17th. And on the 19th, Philip Margolin, John Land, R.G. Belsky, and Alan Topol, strong female characters.
Wow.
Yeah, this was one of my things. The 24th, ending in June. I'm not doing anything in July at all. The 24th, the author of Murmur of the Bees. It's interesting. And the 27th, W.H. Wheaton, Emily Eternal. She's an artificial consciousness. I read the book and I go like, oh my God, this is really scary.
Wow.
So that's for June. And then I start back August 6th with the one and only Carter Wilson, The Dead Girl in 2A. Oh my God, is that scary too. And I just have to announce, because I'm excited, Silent Voice is my new book. My Faces Behind the Stone series came out yesterday on Amazon. So it's now on paperback and Kindle. And I want to thank R.G. Belsky, John Land, Vincent Zandri, Alan Topol, and a whole bunch more people for giving me blurbs and telling me that the book was good and made me feel good. So, you chose the title, The Naming Game. Why did you choose that, and why did so many people give up so many names?
Well, I chose the title kind of, when I was writing it, you know, I was struggling to come up with a title because, you know, often things associated with the McCarthy era often carry titles with red in it. You know, the Red Scare, the Red This. And I wanted to, as I was writing, the thing that came to my mind was like a nursery rhyme. You know, I'm blanking on the actual rhyme, but there's a rhyme about like when you're trying to get somebody's profession, you know, Tinker, Tailor, Spy. So I was thinking about the idea that, you know, it's a naming game and you keep naming things to try to identify people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, also the idea of, you know, you have a name, but are you what your name is, you know? So there was that element. As to why people gave up names, I think there was a lot of peer pressure. I think a lot of people were, I think there was a subset of people that were very sincere about their fear of communism and the fear that, you know, the country was under threat. You know, Russia was the new enemy. You know, we now have the atomic bomb. You know, it was considered a foreign enemy, but that could now be on domestic soil. So I think there was genuine patriotism, but it got misdirected. And I think there was also a sense of paranoia because it wasn't, an enemy like, the Nazis, where you see the uniform or see the symbol and you knew what they were. The idea of a communist was it could be, the little lady down the street. It could be the college professor. It could be the guy selling the newspaper. And, everybody's doing things in secrecy. The series, The Americans, really, I think, captures that, where even then, you have the FBI looking for these spies, but we don't know what they look like. They could be Russians, but now they speak English. They look American. They live in suburbia. And that particular series is set in the 80s. And I thought very, very well done.
That's scary. So tell us, Leslie comes into play and is a covert role as the secretary for Dr. Ernest.
Yes.
And Walker immediately perks up. And he's happy that she's there. How come? But he can't really let anybody know that he knows she's there because that would give away why he's there.
Right. I was trying to do the, I was trying to have fun here in the sense that, Walker and Leslie have a history. They know each other from the book one. And, he now realizes that she's working as the secretary for this doctor. And Jack never told him. So, there's that element that, Jack's going to do what he wants to do, but also that element of trust. There's a reason Jack has to be doing this, but it's a surprise for him. He walks in there. John Hamilton walks in there and sees it. He kind of has a sense of humor about it. And I think, one of the things I did with Leslie here was show her, we know, well, you might know from book one, if you didn't read it, I think you sense that she's her own person and she's a strong person, but she's tolerating a lot. She has this boss who treats her like a servant, and he definitely crosses the line a couple of times on how he talks to her and how he acts to her, but again, that was very common in that era. I think anybody who's watched Mad Men realizes that guys did not treat women well in the office, if they were in the office at all. So
it's not too different now sometimes, too. I mean, I've got a lot of books like that. Yeah, unfortunately, I know. Discrimination is everywhere. But this part I found very interesting. Why did Warner want Walker to write a script about concentration camps in Poland? And why wouldn't anyone want to watch this during that time period? And I can understand that, because the first story in Silent Voices is my grandmother's story. She was in a Polish sterilization camp. So that's based on
right,
the story.
Right.
So why wouldn't anybody want to watch that? This is a hard thing to watch, even now.
It is a hard thing to watch. And we know now in retrospect that the Army and independent journalists that were working with the military went in and, filmed the liberation of these camps, but they did not disclose it to the public too much later because it was just so shocking. And, the view was that people aren't ready for this. I think, with Jack Warner, when you look at his work, he had a very I think strong sense of morality, which interesting, is kind of contradictory, but with some of the things he did in his personal life. But he believed in stories having a sense of morality and direction. And when he finds out that Walker had been in the Army and had been there when the camp was liberated, he asks him to write about it and gives him carte blanche. He's like, because I think Jack was always looking at it from the standpoint, Jack Warner, that whatever you write can be edited, but just, put it down on paper. And, that's the advice, with any writer, just get it all on paper and then work with what you have after. I think Jack Warner partly because he was Jewish, wanted to learn about this firsthand. And I think maybe from a business point, he thought that he could maybe sell the idea. I mean, he did take chances with some storylines that he had. But I think, as you said earlier, the reality is I don't think people were ready for something like that. You know, you couldn't do a movie like Sophie's Choice in 1951. You know, people would have just imploded.
I don't know. I think so, too. I don't think people would have readily taken up on it. You know, there are some people even now that wouldn't take up on it. Some people still think that it never really happened. That's just even scarier.
Well, I mean, if you think 1951, I mean, certain things were risque. I mean, you know, it was still risque to show a woman smoking. It was risque to show how much, you know, of her body that you would expose. Showing a woman in a bikini was scandalous. You know, so when you're dealing with things that are actually on the level of atrocity and murder, you know, that makes everything else pale by comparison. So, and it's still a taboo topic, not just the Holocaust, but other aspects of genocide in our day and age. You know, people know about it, but they don't necessarily want to see the pictures.
Well, Vera doesn't always seem like she's coherent at times, but she's odd at times. And how come? And also think that if Walker had his choice, he probably would have stayed with the studio because he liked what he was doing. I don't think so.
Well, I think Vera is just, you know, she's in some ways still a party girl. I mean, she wants to have fun. I mean, that I think psychologically that's a way for her to have control in her life. I mean, here's a woman who was an actress for, you know, 2 or 3 decades, and her whole life has been run and dictated by men, you know, sitting behind a desk. And, you know, fortunately she, you know, has her own wealth. She has her house. She has an apartment in L.A. But, you know, she wants to work. She's a creative person, and, you know, she likes to drink. She likes to party, and I don't blame her.
I don't blame her either. I just crossed out one question because I realize if I say what happened to somebody, it's going to give it away. So I just crossed that out.
Right.
So, but when the pieces fall into place, what happens to the rest of the people in the studio?
Life goes on. They still have a job. You know, that's, you know, as the saying goes, and the show must go on. I mean, somebody still has to write it. Somebody still has to film it. Somebody has to play the parts. And I think that's, you know, potentially one of the messages you can walk away with is that despite things that happen that are awful and horrific and damaging, life goes on. And in this case, you know, the thing that's a little bit cynical about it, I guess, is that money has to be made. And that's the whole thing during the McCarthy era. The Hollywood studios still made money. You know, labeling people, whether it was actors or writers, they still pushed and they made money and they made profits. You know, they did not suffer. They just, you know, put on a mask of concern and
went about getting
the job done. Right.
So this is a question. I'm just sitting here doodling. This is really not good.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, you know, they have the Oscars, the Tonys, the Emmys, and all of that. The Oscars are for movies.
Uh-huh.
So if a specific studio or a specific film gets a lot of, you know, awards and gets a lot of Oscars or gets a lot of nominations, that must give the studio a lot more money too. And you know, I'm terrible because I don't know if I would think it's necessary to spend millions of dollars on an award show just to tell somebody that's getting millions of dollars you did a good job. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, the way I look at it is, I mean, obviously the Oscars are meant to celebrate, you know, the performances in various categories and whatnot. But we also know now that, you know, studios, as you said, you know, they bankroll advertisements. They are very strategic about when they release films, because they know that if they release a film at a certain time of the year, people are going to remember it. And then, you know, they're more likely to nominate it. Whereas if it's released at a different part of the year, it's like amnesia. They forgot about it. I don't, and it's, this kind of sounds awful to say, but I don't think the awards, I think the awards mean something to the people that work in the industry that are actors, because it's a recognition by their peers. But I think from a studio standpoint, yes, it gives them bragging rights, but I think ultimately what's more important to them is filling the seats, you know, making the money, getting people to come out during the summer and watch the action film or watch, you know, whatever. That's more important, because there are a lot of films that were excellent that never got Oscar nominations, just like there's many actors and actresses who were tremendous artists that never got an Oscar nomination, or maybe if they did, they never won it. So I think the Oscars and those type of awards are important for people who, you know, devote their lives to their craft. For the studios, I think ultimately it's just about money. You know, if they can make a movie about something and anything, as long as it makes money, that's all they care about.
You know something, they don't make the quality of movies that they did back and a long time ago also. And I watch a lot of them on, you know, on HBO or shows, whatever it is, on television. It just seems that to spend so much money on a movie, depending on what it is, it's just like I could watch it on television because I'm paying a fortune for internet and whatever.
Well,
but,
I mean, things have changed in the sense that, like, now they spend a lot, they budget a lot for CGI and special effects. And, you know, that's where a lot of money goes. You know, another thing that's very, very different, which I actually think is pretty cool, is a lot of actors are making money, as even if you think about it, as they get older, but they do a lot of voice work. You know, they do voice work for these animations, you know, animated films, which I think is phenomenal. But it also reminds me of the 1930s when people used to listen to radio. I mean, you're not seeing anything, you're just hearing it. But it's a lot of creativity to be able to do voice and do your voice in such a way that you're conveying the emotion, and then having somebody create an animated dog or whatever, conveying the emotions on his or her face, you know, that go along with the voice.
I think a lot of people, my husband does, he watches all those animated cartoon programs. He likes them better than the regular pros. So he's into them, and I'm going like, how did they create that? How did they make that character? How come the dog is my favorite character in the whole show? I mean, seriously,
You can take the idea of how much money is spent on films, or, you know, I don't want to say, you know, like how much an actor is paid. You know, if an actor is being paid millions and millions of dollars, they know that person's going to bring three times, four times what they're being paid, ideally. But, you know, sometimes I sit there and think, you know, with all the money that we or the studios spend on this, you know, people are spending to go to the theater, or they're watching Netflix or whatever now, streaming. But I think about all the money that's being spent that way. I often wonder how much of the writers are being paid. And, you know, you think about that kind of budget, and you think about school systems that can't even, you know, teachers that can't even get books and crayons for their kids.
Which brings up the fact that I agree with you, because I taught for 36 years. I was a reading and writing staff developer at Nadine, and I was constantly in the dollar store buying notebooks, pens, pencils and stuff.
Right.
Because the book room... the guy in the book room would give me whatever I wanted. But there were some parents that couldn't afford notebooks. There were some parents that couldn't afford pencils and pens. And it was funny because they would come up to my room in the morning and go, okay, what do you need? And it was like a supply closet. And it didn't bother me because the kids really did very, very well. I mean, you're right. They can't afford to buy a lot of stuff, and I think the school systems really need to be reworked. And after teaching for so many years, at least I'm proud to say that my students still love me, and they're on Facebook, and they're doing very well. But, yeah, I agree. So what is next for the company, and what's next for you?
Right, but, I mean, so what's next for me? Well, I have the third book written. It's called Diminished Fifth. And this time we're in New York. We're still in the 50s, obviously. This time we're in New York and we're off Broadway. So we're dealing with an off Broadway play. Walker, you know, gets a chance to investigate, do a little bit of writing. Now what's different about Diminished Fifth as opposed to the first two books is I have two characters in the first book, Sheldon and Tanya, reappear. They are in the third book, particularly Tanya. You meet Sheldon briefly in book two, but you really don't know that much about him. So in book three, Diminished Fifth, you're going to see more of their characters, particularly Tanya. And Tanya is now a young teenager. Mm. And she's a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked her in that book. I'm glad you're bringing her back. I really am glad you're bringing them back. And where can everybody learn more about you? Go on.
I'm sorry?
No, go on. What else are you writing?
Oh, no, the third book is a lot of fun because I get to show 50s New York. I wrote it before Mrs. Maisel came out, which, as you know, is set in Manhattan. It was a lot of fun, but I like to think the second book, you know, The Naming Game, which you just read, is a little bit lighter than the first one. The third book, Diminished Fifth, is going to be like the first one in the sense that it's darker. It's a darker, brooding type of book because of things that happen.
When is it coming out?
You know, I don't know. I have it in the queue for editing with my publisher, Winter Goose, and we have not finalized the schedule yet, but I'm hoping that it'll come out sometime in spring of next year. I'm hoping.
I'm hoping, too. This way I can put it in my schedule before I get blogged up.
Yes.
So those people that are listening, August is gone. September is just about gone.
Yes.
And I can't believe it. And I've got a couple in October, and I've got three in November and two in December. So if anybody has a book that's coming out and they want an interview or whatever, you better speak up now. Well, I don't know. But where can everybody find out about you and your work and what websites and everything so they can buy the books? And I've got hands out for this one, let me tell you.
Sure. So both books are available in print and digital Kindle. They're available on Amazon. You can find them there. You can also find me on my publisher's website, WinterGoosePublishing.com. I have a website, which is basically my first name and last name.com. So just spell that out. And I have a blog called gabrielswharf.wordpress.com. Mm. And I'm also on Twitter, the @ GVALJAN. So you can find me there. I tweet, fairly regularly. I'm on Facebook. I'm not sure how to explain how to find me on Facebook. I guess if you type in my name, you'll find me that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's several different ways you can find me.
No, I found you. but I want to thank you so very, very much. I do panel shows, so if I see something that might interest you, I'll email you myself and let you know.
Okay.
Because you never know when I'm going to do something. Yeah, because, strong characters are really interesting, but I think I haven't done one on time periods and why people choose specific time periods. And John Land does, and Alan Topel does, and a few others do. They choose specific time periods in history, and that keeps me interesting. But I have to tell you, there are like seven people that I've told about this book, and they wanted it, and I told them, that's why you have Amazon, and get it yourself.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want everybody to have a nice day. Gabriel, thank you so much. This has been fun. Cheryl's been listening. This is a phenomenal show. If you didn't read The Naming Game, I don't know what you're waiting for. Start with the first one. It's fantastic, and you'll love this one even more. And friends, ready for the next one. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, friend.